Welcome to Shifting Power Through Feminisms, a podcast series born from the African Feminisms Gathering held in Johannesburg in September 2025. Over 4 days, feminists from across the continent and across generations came together through ritual, art, activism, and dialogue to reimagine power, challenge injustice, and build futures grounded in care, creativity, and collective strength. This podcast doesn't recount the gathering, it continues its conversations. In the 3 episodes, we explore how African feminists are responding to a time of polycrisis, how well-being and healing shape sustainable movements, and how men can engage meaningfully as allies in feminist struggles. These episodes carry forward the spirit of the gathering's core themes, rights, representation, and resources, while inviting listeners into the ongoing work of shifting power through feminisms. So let's keep the conversation moving.
Welcome to the After the Gathering, an unpacking of African feminisms and allyship. This is an episode where we explore the diverse and powerful landscape of feminist thought and action across the African continent. I'm your host, Sintle, and joining me today is Leo. We're having a deep dive into crucial and often debated topics around the role of men in African feminist movements. We often hear the question, can men be feminists? Or what is a male ally? We're going to be unpacking all these things and more alongside Leo and making sure that you join us on this journey of unpacking African feminisms. Leo, how are you today? Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Sintle. My name is Leo Wamwanduka. I'm a Zimbabwean. I'm an activist. At the moment, I'm working at the University of Pretoria in the Center for the Advancement of Scholarship as a postdoctoral researcher, and my work looks at men and care work, and particularly at the moment focusing on Zimbabwean migrant men and how they show care to each other within the Johannesburg urban area. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you so much, Leo.
Yeah, just to thank you for inviting me to this very interesting debate and discussion, which I think it's quite topical, especially at this moment when we are celebrating the 16 days of activism, you know, against gender violence, violence against women. So it's quite a timely discussion, and also I think the gathering sort of set the tone for a very good discussion into this topic.
Yeah, I think the Goethe Institute has been very deliberate about centering the voices of African feminisms, and the gathering, I mean, it took place in September, and a huge part of it was also unpacking this notion of rights, resources, and also representation. And some of the themes that came up were really tied to how we weave our personal journeys and discuss the practicalities of allyship and reimagine the future that we want to build together as African feminists. But I think from a personal standpoint, can you share your personal journey into feminism? Was there a specific moment or experience growing up that challenged your preconceived notions of gender and masculinity?
Yeah, I must say for me growing up, I grew up in the township, in Harare. And in most township settings, it's really hard to reimagine your masculinity. So they are really set up roles about, you know, what is expected to be a man. You're supposed to stand on the corner and look strong and tough and aggressive in order for you to sort of survive in that kind of context. So I would say for me, my earliest realization was, through my mom's influence, to a large extent, because my mom had 6 boys, so we are 6 in our family. Sure. So we're a family of 6 boys,
yeah.
And and my mom is a stay at home mom even now, and she always used to tell her neighbors that I don't have a girl child, so I'm going to train my boys to do all the household chores,
yeah,
to do everything that And growing up in a township, that was really, really, really something fascinating for us, because we would resist it as boys and say,
really?
this is not our job, as boys. And also for the other boys in the community.
Yes, the other boys would also be curious, why are you
exactly,
cleaning the house?
How come, you can't say, I can't come out to play because I'm doing the dishes and stuff, So I think from that early age, it sort of shaped my perceptions around roles and responsibilities, and that, you know, there was really nothing wrong in doing so-called feminine, you know, feminine roles. And then fast forward maybe 15, you know, 10 years from there, when I went to university, and then I met a group of feminists. There was a lady, she's now Professor Tsitsi Mashauri. So she was leading this movement of, you know, of young women in universities that was mobilizing people against violence against women in, you know, in universities, and in particular against beauty pageants, because, you know, this group was saying beauty pageants in universities are objectifying women. Mm. So even though I didn't understand it, it sort of, it sounded very interesting, you know. And I got a T-shirt with, you know, this is what a feminist looks like, you know, and, you know, and I could go to, you know, as a student going to like a hotel for a conference or something very big. So I think, you know, from those sort of early days of attending a training of trainers workshop in gender and feminism in 2003, actually, you know, I then began to really explore more and be more active, you know, within my peer circles and also within my wider society, you know, working on, you know, working on gender and masculinities issues. Yeah.
So I'm curious. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously growing up in a household so much testosterone and navigating that space in a township setting, where do you think that consciousness then landed? Was it by the time you met your professor, went to university, or were there inklings that sort of came from the homestead, from your mom, that sort of were leaning towards feminisms or equality for both genders? Like, where would you sort of position that actual consciousness taking leap?
Yeah, I think in a very formal sense, you know, that consciousness took root when I was in university. That's when sort of the penny dropped, like, oh, okay, this is, you know, we really, you know, men and women experience the world differently, and that it's more than roles. It's more than, it's actually more than just the cleaning and, you know, and, you know, and, you know, and the violence and all of this. It's actually about, you know, things that are systemic, you know, that there's actually a system out there that is benefiting men and women differently. So in a formal sense, it came, you know, the penny dropped at that moment. But, you know, when I reflect back, I actually feel like, you know, even though my mom today does not identify as a feminist, you know, and she wouldn't say what she did was feminist, but what she and the other women in the township where I grew up were doing with their boys or with their boy children was actually very feminist. And it planted, you know, the seeds that, you know, when I then went to boarding school, for example, you know, I had to iron my clothes. Mm-hmm. I had to clean my spoon and my cup and stuff. And it wasn't so hard for me to do because, you know, I'd done it. And then in university, you know, I think here these days you hear many guys saying many male students saying I've a raised wife, you know, because they need a woman in their life when they're in residence that can take the role that those, you know, the role of the cleaner, like a mother and the caretaker. But I feel like for men like me and the others that I grew up with, we were privileged to have been exposed to another way of being, of being men. And I emphasize the township background because a lot of the times when people hear about township, they think they have the wildest imaginations that it's the most misogynistic and most backward of places. But my message today is that, you know, there is another. There's a danger to a single story, you know, like what Chimamanda Ngozi said, you know, and the other story that's not told is how, you know, how communities or women or, you know, influential leaders within the township actually, you know, give positive role models that, you know, that assist men and boys to reimagine what it means to be men, to be more egalitarian, to be, you know, to take on sort of care activities, to take on softer forms of masculinities, and still take that up as a, you know, as their identity, as men.
That's such an interesting dynamic, Leo, because we live in a continent where it's still seeped in so much patriarchy, but also the understanding of equality is jaded. So to have women in that mindset shift to say, actually, I will treat my children equally, regardless of whether they're male or female, right? But another common pushback that we often hear is around feminism being a Western import or an ideology. Mm. How do you then define African feminism? And how do you navigate the perception around it being a Western notion with your own community and family?
Yeah, I think for me, it really starts with me and my grounding and my beliefs and how I sort of see feminism. And I think my starting point is usually, you know, the fact that that the concept of feminism or the word feminist might sound foreign, but the essence of it, you know what it means to be a feminist, like to resist subjugation, to resist colonization, to advocate for equality, to treat others the way that you want to be treated, to protect the environment, to conserve nature. So when I look at the concept of Ubuntu, for example,
yeah.
You know, I am because you are.
Yeah.
That is the most feminist idea that I can relate to on the African continent because it really sort of encapsulates, you know, the fact that we need to treat each other. Not just each other as humans, but also the environment and and animals and and everything around us the same, because they are a part of us. They are not external to us. So by being good to each other and by being by holding each other in good esteem, we tend to move our society forward. So in short, for me, feminism is not really a Western import. And to quote the African Women's Charter, which was written, I think, a couple of 14 years ago by African women that sat down, I think, in Nairobi, and they wrote this amazing document, which is called the African Feminist Charter. They actually say that they find it very disrespectful when people say that it's, you know, African feminism. I mean, that feminism is not an African, is a Western import, because they trace the struggles, women's struggles from women in the marketplace in Nigeria, for example, or the Dahomey warriors in Benin and Togo, very important anti-colonial figures like Mbuya Nyanda, for example, in Zimbabwe, who actually stood up to the British, and she was the only person, Nyanda, who stood up, to fight what was called the first Chimurenga, and was a woman, or the Ashanti women kings, that were rulers on their own.
Yeah.
So for this grouping, for African feminist and African feminist scholars, you know, the essence of feminism is predates colonialism, that we did not have to wait for people from the West to come and do round tables and workshops and, for us to know about feminism.
But also, I think it's a reality that that's how our communities were constituted, right? In the Afrocentric sense. And this came out a lot in the gathering, with feedback from colleagues and comrades from, you know, West Africa and East Africa, particularly, to say, even in challenging these Western ideologies around looking at Africa as this other continent that isn't necessarily established in certain ways, they're indigenous ways of knowledge that have been seeped through feminisms, mm-hmm. and may not necessarily have the jargon and the language attached to Western ideologies, but they've been there
and are
also inherent. And I'm glad that you raised Ubuntu, because that's sort of a pivotal aspect that we lead from, right?
Yeah.
Particularly from a humanity standpoint. So we can definitely unpack the feminisms around it, but from a humanity aspect to say, I see you because you are me, you know?
Yeah.
But we then are sitting with the challenge of how do we build on that, you know? What specific traditional cultural norms around being strong, in control, have you found challenging to unlearn because of this African-centric lens that we have, and even gaze that we give to men or to young boys? How has that process of unlearning unfolded for you and also impacted your relationships, right?
Because
I'm sure you come from friendship groupings where, you know, masculinity is how you lead. How loud can you shout? You know, how strong are you? So what's that unlearning look like for you?
Wow, that's a very loaded question, you know, because it's so... it's so fascinating and challenging, you know, at the same time. And I mean, I must say, you know, as I said, I began formally agitating for women's rights and also for positive or caring masculinities since 2003, which is like 22 years ago. So I've given 22 years of my life to this. You know, to this journey. And I feel like, there have been lots of ups and downs in terms of unlearning, you know, unlearning things. Because when I started this activism, I was, you know, it was just me and my convictions. And maybe I lost some friends because it didn't feel cool. You know, it wasn't like there was like this unwritten code that you don't talk about these things, and that as a man, you are not supposed to be to be that sympathetic, you know, to the women's cause, and that there was a very clear line between what is for men and what is for women. So to some extent, I have experienced a lot of pushback, even now, from other men within my circles, and also other men in places where I do my advocacy work, that still feel that, for example, that a lot of men are oppressed, you know. I mean, I'm working in the university setup at the moment, you know, and I hear like a lot of men passing comments like, "Oh, since the Me Too movement started, now I don't know how to relate with my female students anymore because of this." So I see that as backlash. So there's a lot of backlash that happens, and also, within peer groups, it's harder to call things out, you know. So I say this with this with my background in mind, that, you know, I left I've been a migrant for more than 15 years now. So I left Zimbabwe and lived in Germany for 5-6 years, and lived in Ecuador, and lived now, you know, in South Africa. And I think as a man or as a person who is trying to make friendships and to create a social circle, it's always hard when you find good people that you think you can connect with in all these places, in Germany, in Ecuador, and also in South Africa, that you feel that you connect with. And then suddenly, you know, the deeper you get into the relationship, you realize how misogynistic or how sort of the micro sexist aggressions that they... that they espouse. So always the challenge is then, you know, because moving has a lot of loneliness. I hold on to the relationship,
or do you
with
adapt?
This, you know, or do I adapt to that? So in many of the instances, I've had to like totally let go of friendships and let go of, or not go to specific peer group activities, you know, that I know that there would be some toxicity that would be going on.
I mean, it sounds lonely. It sounds difficult because not a lot of men have also tapped into that one awareness, but also deliberateness to say, I'm an ally and this is what I'm going to espouse to, especially from a value standpoint.
Yeah.
But I think even when we look at allyship, particularly in action, in showing up outside of the tick box exercise, there's this huge matter around intersectionality as well. And when we put up African feminists and their struggles, they're not monolithic, right?
So the
gathering showcase that you deal with a myriad of topics related to class, sexuality, more, How does your work then as an ally actively consider this intersectionality? So, for instance, if we talk about LGBTQIA rights, how do you then show up as an ally in those spaces that are also pro-feminism?
Yeah, I think for me, you know, as an ally, and this is the advice I give to all the men I work with, that the most important thing as an ally is to sit down and listen and learn and unlearn and be part of that group, whether you are an ally in the anti-racist movement or in the, you know, in the LGBTIQ movement or in the broader feminist movement. I think it's really important to really sit down and really let go of your inhibitions, or your, if you have a PhD in gender studies, put it aside, you know, and really sit down and hear people's lived realities and, you know, relate from that perspective, not from the perspective of a knower or someone who has who wields power in any way, you know. And when I also talk to men, you know, I also emphasize that this idea that we should, as men, in as male allies in this struggle, we should not seek to get attention, you know, or to get
Visibility or.
Yeah, visibility, I think, is good. But I think, you know, visibility to other men, especially for me, I feel like, you know, if I'm in a group of strong feminist women, I wouldn't go there and say, I'm a feminist, I'm going to tell you what to do, you know. I will sit down and listen. But when I'm at the football, you know, or at a shisanyama or somewhere, and then someone says something, and then, you know, I will definitely say that this is, you know, as a feminist, this, you know, I do not stand for this. So I feel like visibility for male allies is important within male groups, you know, so that other men can see, because, you know, because this feminist discourse is not like like the cigarette business, you know, where men actually gravitate towards, you know, or any narcotic, you know, that men like, you know. A lot of men feel emasculated, you know, when they have a female boss at work, or they feel that this shift in attention from, you know, from them as the patriarchs to women becoming breadwinners, for example, is something. So I work, for example, at the moment with African migrants, Zimbabwean migrants in South Africa, and a lot of the men struggle with just the fact that, you know, women, the women in their lives that work in the informal sector are actually making much more than them, because the, you know, the formal industry is not paying as much, and they find it hard to accept that you can still earn less than your partner and still be a man. And I've also met very, I don't know, prominent or strong feminists that really feel that issues of LGBTQIs are a distraction to the broader sort of either feminist movement or men allyship movement. Because, you know, a lot of men, when they, you know, when they say that they espouse softer, caring forms of masculinity, immediately society labels them as gay, you know. And and some of the men actually shy away from that label and say, no ways, I'm not, you know, I'm not a gay. I support these ideas. You know, there's always this apology that's unsaid.
But
that,
don't,
you know,
associate
that, associate with, you know, or, you know, they wouldn't invite someone who is queer to their bri, because, you know, because everyone in the, you know, in their friend circle will, you know, will start to talk. So for me, you know, it's important, you know, in my allyship to listen, to be as inclusive as possible, and to sit down, you know, with as many diverse groups as, you know, as possible. And for me, like, you know, I mean, as I said, as a migrant man, you know, having lived in Europe, for example, and in South America, where maybe at some point, I don't know, for many years, I was the only black person in the room, and I felt the being othered. I felt that just my presence, because of my skin color, made a lot of waves or elicited a lot of there was tension in the room. You know, people would either try to overcompensate, you know, to show that they are not racist, or they would go, you know. So for me, when I see the kind of othering that marginalized groups such as LGBTIQ and other queer groups experience. You know, even though I don't have the same exact experience, I notice that it's the same structure at work, and that it is also part of my struggle as a person. Yeah. So for me, being an ally is not to save women or to save, you know, marginalized groups, but in a big way, it's to save myself from all of this misogyny and the patriarchal attitudes, you know, that I was unfortunate to have been raised in, and to live in a world where you know, where it's mostly patriarchal. So when they say it's a men's world, that's exactly what they mean. That you know, that only men can walk at night in Joburg. Only men can enjoy leisure activities, you know, without being harassed. Only men can, you know, go to the office without holding their keys in their hands because someone is going to, is going to, you know, and none of my friends has a taser. None of my male friends, you know, has a taser. Mm. But I know, like, women and queer people that have to move with a taser, you know, or something to protect themselves because, you know, it's not, you know, the system is not safe for them because they identify as that.
So it's a bit of a minefield, right? Because you're navigating the space, but you're also trying to maintain your well-being. But how does it look like practically at home? What does being a feminist ally look like in your daily life? Can you give us some practical examples of how you share, you know, domestic responsibilities like caregiving or emotional labor in your domestic settings?
Yeah, that's a minefield there. Yeah, because, you know, what I learned is that it's one thing talking about feminism at, you know, at conferences and going and traveling and, you know, and holding placards. But then when you come home, you know, the game really changes because, you know, within the familial space, there's a lot of care work that needs to be done. There's also the wider community sort of, you know, because I'm, you know, as a Zimbabwean, I live in a kinship system where what I do, you know, my grandfather, you know, might actually want to, you know, to sort of have a say in that, or like someone else within the family might say, oh, you know, maybe it's a family gathering. They might say, oh no, you should sit down. You know, the women are the ones that are serving food. So for me, my activism has really tried to cross those boundaries, you know, to say, you know, when I go to a family gathering or to a wedding or a traditional ceremony, even in the village, you know, to do those things that are usually assigned to women, to say, okay, I'm going to be here and I'm going to be, you know, to be practically sort of, you know, helping, you know, that's at the community level. And then at the personal, at the home level, you know, as I said, I left home 15 years. I left Zimbabwe 15 years ago. I was a CEO of an NGO, you know. But I left my job as an accompanying spouse because my partner works for a German foundation, you know. So suddenly from being a CEO of an NGO with lots of privileges, even though I was doing like a lot of gender work, then I'm living in Berlin, it's dark and it's cold, I have no idea how to navigate, and suddenly, you know, and also getting help is very expensive, it's like 10-15 euros an hour. So I had to switch from being a CEO to becoming a cleaner, to becoming, you know, to take my, you know, my kids on the train to go to kindergarten, or to take my kids on the train to go to, you know, to primary school and to pick them up, and to, you know, to think about what needs to be cooked for dinner that night, and to make sure that when my partner comes home tired at 8 in the evening, you know, I'm actually there to make sure that, you know, there's food on the table. And, you know, so for me, that shift was not easy. You know, it really sort of shook me to the core because I thought, wow, you know, I've been working in this field of, you know, of gender and gender equality and feminist theory. And I was really like the theory of it and all of it was really, you know, but like shifting to actually doing it without the helper. You know, it's easy when you have someone who's, when you have, you know, when you're dedicated staff who's doing that. But when you know that it's just the two of you in this cold country, and if you don't, if there's no food, you know, cooked, you know, when one of you comes home, then it means you are all going to be hungry for that, for that. Yeah. So for me, on a practical level, it was more, taking on those roles and being sort of the main person in charge. And even now when I work at the university, I go there 3 times a week, but then Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but then the other 2 or 3, 4 days, I have to be at home, I have to make sure, I take my kids, to swimming practice. I take my, tonight, I know what they're going to eat because I'm the one, I make decisions about what they eat for lunch and for dinner and all of that. Yeah. Mm. So, I mean, this is not to sort of elevate myself to this very high level of knowing everything. But I think it's more to show, I think for me, to other men that this is possible, and also to show that it's difficult. It's not easy. It's really hard because it has very practical implications. So it means when other guys are going out on a Friday night to a shisa nyama, I have to tell them that I can't be there because I have to make sure that, that my kids are tucked into bed, and I have to make sure that, they ate something. Or if my partner is traveling for 2 or 3 weeks and I'm the only one, with our help, like now in South Africa, I have helpers, I have people that can help, But then at the end of the day, I'm the point person. Yeah. I have to be there to make sure. So all of those things, make it quite challenging and present sort of unique ways that one has to navigate relationships with other men, with friends, and also at work. I have to say, this week I'm unable to come for 2 days because my child is sick and I have to, or when I go to the doctor and the doctor asks me, how come is the third time you're coming with your child? Are you single? Where's the mother? Or something like that. It's always very interesting because those roles are, I take my kids for vaccinations. I take my, for most of those things, But this is not to say that my partner is totally lazy and she's not, she's not in the picture. But, we have a good way of distributing,
And collaborating.
The roles and collaborating. Yeah. And for us, it's very clear that she is the one with the main job and I sort of take on secondary jobs like consultancies
and supporting.
But then my main role is to be the one that's in the.
But even at that main role and the responsibilities that are then divided between yourselves, how awkward is it to then call out other men in those settings? You mentioned, having conversations with male colleagues and them sort of looking at you to say, what do you mean you're doing a school run or you're taking your child to the doctor? How do you then approach challenging, sexist remarks or inappropriate behavior amongst your male friend towards you or to other colleagues, females or males, and challenging them in a way that's constructive, but not necessarily performative, and it's sort of this dynamic of yes, calling out, but not from a standpoint of, oh, look at me, I'm an ally, so I can call you out, but in a constructive way that makes sense to say, do better.
I think that's a good question. Was for me, at some point in the peer groups where people really know me and I'm close to them, as soon as I get there, the dynamic changes, I can actually see that some of the jokes probably that they would say before, they wouldn't say. Or if somebody says a sexist joke, then another person in the group would say, come on, don't say that, the feminist guy is here. So for me, in a way, I'm worried about that because it seems like it's behavior that happens, because I'm there,
in your absence they have free reign.
So it means that in my absence, but then at the same time, I feel like there's something happening, there is like a change that they're actually seeing that, okay, because this guy is doing things like this, then there's this other way of looking at it. And then I also see sometimes when they're showing off, they actually try to say, oh, I'm doing this, look, I'm taking my kids to, you know, to biking or to, you know, or to horseback riding or like what Leo does, because he's, I mean, they mockingly say it, but you can actually see that,
that there's a level of pride.
It's like a pride and acknowledgement that, oh, this is actually something, you know. So for me, I like how the change is slow and silent and takes place in very invisible, you know, ways. But also at the same time, I really sort of try to embody some of these principles and really say, you know, say things or say, I think it's called the bystander principle, you know, where if someone says something, you really react to it in that particular moment and not text them later or say something later, you know, which I found sometimes can be embarrassing to the person who you are saying it to. But also, I found sometimes myself being embarrassed on their behalf because I'm not so, I don't want to feel like I'm policing how others are talking or how others, you know. But I feel that within the male allyship space, this is the discomfort that we have to, you know, that we have to live with. And instead of us going to feminist workshops and participating and raising our hands and dominating, I feel that we should be talking more to our peers and to be creating, to be having those dialogues with our peers in order for us to be visible to them and also for them to sort of understand, you know, where these issues are coming from.
You know, earlier when we started our conversation, you mentioned that South Africa is currently observing 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. And it's a real scourge that's obviously been declared now as a national disaster by the South African president. And far from it being a real pandemic that people are living through daily, in your view, what are some of the most effective ways that male allies can address and prevent GBV within their immediate social circles? You reference, you know, shisanyamas and going to pubs, etc. What proactive and effective ways can male allies within your circle have those conversations and also have preventative measures around, you know, GBV?
Yeah, it's a very sad situation that we are experiencing in South Africa, but also, you know, across the world, you know, these issues are
100%.
Are happening in Berlin, you know, 100%. In New York, in, you know, in, I don't know, in New Delhi, you know, all of these issues are quite topical. And I feel that for me, one of the effective strategies is for us as men to redefine what it means to be a man and to take up more nurturing or more caring forms of our masculinities, you know, to know that we don't have to dominate anyone. We don't have to, you know, to be aggressive. We don't have to, you know, and that also, that ending GBV is also in our own interest as men, because 99% of the violence that is experienced by men in this country and across the world is meted out to men by other men, either through gun violence or through knife violence or through non-verbal or verbal, you know, a lot of the, much of the violence that us as men experience comes from other men. And it is in our best interest, you know, I always say, for us to address this big elephant in the room, because at the end of it, it will also benefit us. You know, we will live lives that are, you know, freer from violence, you know, we would probably live longer lives, you know, because, you know, I've seen people shooting each other, you know, in a road rage incident, you know, where it's just cars that have bumped each other and already guns are out and you know.
Whereas you can just swap pictures and leave
and, you know, and go and then, you know, and go to a fender bender and get
and
the,
fixed,
you know, yeah, exactly. And know that you can fix things and, you know. So I feel that, I think, you know, we need to encourage men to, you know, to take on these more nurturing forms of, of masculinities. The dilemma is, how do we do that? How do we do that en masse? You know, how do we do that? You know, because, you know, I mean, I've been to a soccer stadium. I've been to, you know, to a soccer stadium in South Africa. Yeah. And, you know, and the, I don't know, when Kaizer Chiefs is playing Orlando Pirates and people lift their hands and put them down. mostly men also, you know, in a 60,000 capacity stadium, I can assure you 65%, are men. But, you know, one man puts their hand up and brings it down and the next man does it and the whole stadium within seconds does it. So for me, I think that's the kind of impact that we need, that we sort of, you know, not men all singing from the same hymn book, you know, because as we know about African feminisms, you know, there are many masculinities, you know, there is Xhosa masculinity, there's Zulu masculinity, there is, Shona masculinity or Yoruba masculinity, you know, or Lingala masculinity. And I think it's important to sort of work across all of these masculinities and find those things that are positive and promote them, you know, and also to change the narrative. Instead of saying men don't violate, don't, you know, I think we need to say men do, you know, do childcare, change the diaper, do wake up in the middle of the night and, you know, and make the bottle, even if maybe you won't feed the baby, but the first step of making the bottle and bringing it to the bed and making sure participate, be part of it, you know, and sort of, yeah, I think for me, that's sort of where my current focus is. You know, I'm looking at what can men do, you know, what can we promote? How can we change the narrative? So for me, this reimagination of masculinities and feminisms has a lot in my head to do with sort of what can we tell men to do or allies to do so that they can do more of that, you know.
And in sharing that, it's also an issue around language, right? Because I think sometimes we get so jaded with the real men don't, real men should. And it's like there are no real men, there are no fake men, they're just men, you know. And in that allyship, the language must also be clear to say that there's no distinction between, you know, men that are not men or men that are men, you know. So very deliberate language use, but also understanding of the context from a cultural standpoint is important. Allyship is also a journey. It's not a destination. And I wonder where then you ensure that you also are listening to women's perspective in those spaces and feminist perspectives and accepting feedback in certain spaces where it's like, actually, we don't want men here. We actually want to have this conversation by ourselves. Or the inverse, where they're like, come, we're inviting men to come and listen in. Not to necessarily contribute, but listen in. How do you mention that dynamic? Is there a tension or is it critical for you to also then respect those spaces, or how do you then manage that dynamic?
I think it's really critical to acknowledge that space and as a male ally to know that there are spaces and times when you'll be asked to leave the room and when you'll be told that we do not need your allyship at this particular moment, like in a heated moment, you know, some people have actually said, no, you know, I'm so angry right now that the last thing I want to see is a man in the room, any man, you know, and it's important to respectfully leave the space and probably come back at the invitation of that same group to say, okay, at this moment we are actually, we can entertain your presence. And I think the other thing is to not be self-entitled, you know, because I think a lot of men then feel like, because there's so few of men and also women, you know, because there's so few of men that are doing feminist work, you find that a lot of men become elevated, you know, within space, you know.
Let's unpack that, right? Yeah, so this issue of self-entitled, almost as if they're like the champions of male allyship.
Exactly. I wanted to say that. And there are also some harmful programs. I'm sorry to step on people's toes now, you know, that there are some harmful programs that actually coin this term of male gender champions, you know, within the workplace or within, it's like, you know, it's giving men this role that, okay, now women have been doing this for 200-300 years, you know, and they've not been progressing. But now the champions are here.
So we can legitimize it.
The champions are going to fix it and they are coming. And it feeds into this male psyche that, you know, that men are the fixers. Men are the, you know, and that a problem is not a problem enough until men actually see that they, you know, they have a role they have a role to play. And I think feedback is always hard to get, you know, it's really hard. Because for me, for example, because I said there's very few men working in this field, and I'm always seeking, as an ally, I'm always seeking comfort or belonging to, you know, to the feminist queer or the feminist sister groups, you know. But for them, they are sometimes very suspicious that why, how come, you know, how come you are letting go of this privilege and wanting to be a part of this? So there's this thing that I think I'm going to write an article of this, of men that do not belong. You're sort of in a no man's land where other men are suspicious, are resentful of you because you are a traitor. You are a gender traitor. You are literally saying, okay, what men are doing is wrong and what women are saying is right. Mm. And then also on the other end, the women that you are supporting or the queer groups really don't know what to do with you, you know, because some of the issues... Yeah, I mean, it's easy when you have a clear enemy, when you have a clear target to say, you know.
Yeah.
And then you also have other men that are in this space that start to, you know, there's a hashtag, not all men, you know, that then abuse this privilege of being in this space and start to say, you know what, even though you are angry and this, but it's not all men that are not doing this in a way that, and nobody's saying it's all men.
It's such a distraction, like, right? You're like, how do I then distinguish one men, which one?
Which one?
It's such a distraction.
Which one? I mean, should the men that are feminist hold placards when they are walking in Joburg Central at night with a that says, walk freely, I'm feminist, you know? Should they do that? So because the system, I think there's this book called Fear Factory, you know, that talks Pumla's book, you know, it's really good because it really shows that, you know, as a nonviolent man, I don't have to do anything to benefit from a violent system.
100%.
Because if a woman sees me at night in the dark, they will know that they have to change their, it's very automatic.
Yeah. It's a crazy space because I think from a female perspective, it's almost this mental gymnastics that you have to do around men all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm glad that you reference Prof. Gola's book because she talks about how even from a fear component, right, you have these mental gymnastics as a woman. What do I wear? Where am I going? How am I getting there? What's going to happen? Who's there? And you're so caught up in the security aspect that you actually forget to drop your shoulders, relax, enjoy the garden, enjoy, you know, the bike park, because you're constantly at like these tenterhooks of, could that be a suspect? Could that be a suspect?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not necessarily strangers too, right?
Yeah. It's your intimate people. Three in five people in South Africa are killed by their partner.
There we go.
And they cut them up into pieces. And what more in spaces
where you don't have those stats or systems and policing aspects in the rest of a continent where it's not even reported or acknowledged as a national disaster or even as a crime.
Yeah.
And I think we also need to be conscious of that our struggles are not the same. We mentioned earlier how even the notion of African feminisms is not monolithic, right? It's different, it's context-based, but there are golden threads that tie us together and there should be some resilience that's brought from that. And also letting go to say, actually, I don't want to be strong. I actually... Yeah. This is unfair to live in a society like
this, right? That's true.
But I think, Leo, in wrapping up, I want us to really just ground the conversation in practice. If you look at your vision for the future of masculinity in Africa, what are some of the key skills or values that you think young boys need to be taught to help them navigate more gender equal worlds and African feminisms?
I think it's going to sound very cliche, but I think it's important for young men and also older men to know that it's okay to cry. You know, we have a mental health crisis among people of color, especially, or amongst men of color and men in general, that a lot of men die unnecessary deaths because, you know, because they are not crying for help. They are not seeking, mental health and looking after themselves. So I think this idea of having an outlet, of having a friend you can talk to, of opening up, even whether you're opening up in church, at a shisa nyama, or whichever space as a man finds, you know, or as a boy finds to open up. It's good to let go of that steam and let go of all of that pressure to provide and protect, you know, that is put by society on men in order for us to sort of reimagine another way of being men. And for boys, I think there's a very nice, not nice, but like a very interesting Netflix series, I think, that just came out, of how this young boy in the UK sort of learned
lessons.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Learned from the internet, you know, about how to be misogynistic. I think the manosphere is called, this cluster of men and boys that are actually, mobilizing against feminism, is something to look at. So I would say for men and boys, especially boys, to be guided on, on the dangers of the digital sphere, you know, and what they get from games, what they get from, you know, what they get from the internet. You know, where are they getting their ideas about manhood from, you know? How do we shift those spaces that are promoting toxic forms of manhood in order for them to, to be more, to encourage more loving, more caring, and more nurturing kinds of roles. Mm-hmm. And I think beyond just the digital space, from a cultural perspective, I think we need to interrogate some of our traditional cultural ceremonies on, yeah, on yeah, on how we graduate men to, to be boys into men. How can we circumcise the heart and not just the organ, alone, How can we, I'm not saying let's, let's leave all our, all our indigenous knowledge systems or all our, but how can we guide those kinds of ceremonies, especially circumcision ceremonies, to include these notions about being nonviolent, about being caring, about, I think nothing takes away from that ceremony, if it's done in a safe way, and if it's done, to impart the culture and the norms of that particular tribe,
yeah,
but then infused with this knowledge about being loving, just loving, forget about everything else, like what bell hooks says, forget about everything else, but love. How can men love?
Yeah.
How can we, as we graduate from being boys to men, learn to love, and not just to love others, but to love ourselves, to love the environment, and to love, the whole world around us, not in this very fluffy, warm kind of, but to really have this genuine love for humanity and for nature. And I think from that perspective, it is possible to reimagine other ways of, of being men. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, from Cape to Cairo, there are men that are already living
100%.
This, some of them who don't even call themselves feminist. Some of them who are, who are African, some who are Afro-American, Afro-Latino, Afro-German, Afro-Europeans, and all across the world, there are many, 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 many men that are doing. And I think we need to bring those voices together,
yeah,
because most of the violence that's happening to women, at this moment, I think happens because a lot of good men are quiet. They say, I'm not violent. I'm a good guy. I'm not the one doing that to women, but it's important for the good guys to stand up and say to other men, Amadoda Sabelani.
Yeah.
Let's stand up and let's fix this,
yeah,
together, and this is the role model. This is how we can do it.
And that's ultimately allyship, right? That's, yeah, ultimately the galvanizing and coming together for a common good. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Leo, this has been such an incredible, an enlightening conversation. Thank you so much for sharing so openly and vulnerably. And I think it's important that we underscore the complexity of allyship, but also feminisms and context, because what the gathering also highlighted that is that we need more men in the space, right? Yeah, it can't be conversations that happen in isolation. So thank you so, so much for joining us and for sharing openly and vulnerably about the important work that you do, both in the private and the public space. And wishing you all the best. And I think we'll definitely see you. We'll see the incredible work and the mobilization that takes place within your friends and colleagues in that space. So thank you, Leo.
Okay. Thank you so much, Sentle. This has been really like very soul-searching kind of, discussion. And it's nice to pause and reflect and to re-strategize. And I think this has given me quite a lot of things to also think about, some nuggets to follow up on, as I continue on my journey in academia and also in activism on this topic. Thank you.
Fantastic. And that's the episode of After the Gathering, an unpacking of African feminisms and allyship, brought to you by the Goethe Institute. My name is Sintle, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.